Consider the storm that will rise up against you. If you refuse to heed my words, a threefold tidal wave of misery, impossible to escape. For first, the Father will destroy this jagged cliff with thunder and lightning and bury you, still gripped by its embrace, inside it. Then, after an enormous span of time, you will come back again into the light, and Zeus's winged hound, a scarlet eagle, will carve your body into ragged shreds of flesh. He will return day in, day out, as an unbidden guest to feast upon your blackened liver.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Welcome to our series, Guts, and to the second part of our interview with Professor Richard Martin, Anthony and Isabel Raubicek, professor in classics at Stanford University. Today, we will continue to explore the meaning of Prometheus' myth in regards to courage, empathy and compassion, sacrifice and punishment, and the new challenges faced by a 21st century Prometheus. Professor Martin, glad to be talking to you again. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
We will hear now a very resumed version of Aeschylus' Prometheus Bound. But for that, Professor, we need your help. Could you help us reconstruct, with all the pieces available to your knowledge, who the audience was back then expecting this performance to begin?
Yeah, that's a great thought experiment. And if you've been to the Theater of Dionysus in Athens, you'll be able to, in your mind, set the scene. You have the side of a hill that goes right up to the Acropolis. Now, the date of Prometheus Bound is still debated, but let's say it's in maybe 430, 420 BC. There would be the beautifully newly constructed Parthenon on top of that the Acropolis, which still survives. The Theater of Dionysus still survives in a slightly later form. So there are some people seated in the front row, the priest of Dionysus and other city officials. And then section by section, all of your neighbors from all over Attica, which is 1,000 square miles. That's the greater Athens, if you like. They flocked into the city, probably with wives and children. There are very few pieces of evidence, but they do seem to suggest that women attended the theater. We also know that people were not, you know, totally quiet the way you're supposed to be in church, because we have references to people chewing on food and kicking the seats and making noise and reacting, and people probably going freely in and out. So it wasn't like, you know, going to La Scala or something, you're all dressed up. It's much more going to a kind of field day, and it's an all-day event. So you're there with your pillow. Your servant or slave probably brought a couple of pillows. We have evidence of that. You're kind of camped out on the hillside. Maybe you've got a good seat, an actual seat, or maybe you're just sprawled in the dirt, and you're going to see not just one play, but a trilogy of tragedies. And so Prometheus Bound was part of a trilogy. We don't have the other two plays. And then you're going to see a kind of cartoon version called a satyr play, which is like a comedy. And that's going to take you maybe from 8 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. And then you probably go with your friends to local restaurant or tavern. So again, it's that paradox. It's a religious event because there's the priest of Dionysus right in front, kind of presiding over everything, bringing into the theater, even before the show starts, the kind of announcements of awards to people who had been great in battle or to the sons of those who had died in battles that year. And remember, this is a one-time event. So Prometheus Bound would have been performed one morning in one place, and that's it. There's a certain, you know, expectation there, too. It's not like you have a run on Broadway where you can go like Cats and see it 30 years later and it's still playing. So I hope that gives you some of the sense of it's a combination entertainment and religious event and field day and a once a year thing at the same time.
As the stage is set amidst the rugged grandeur of a desolate mountaintop, the atmosphere crackles with tension, mirroring the turmoil within the hearts of those assembled. Kratos and Bia, Zeus's servants, escort an imprisoned Prometheus and Hephaestus, the god of fire and craftsmanship, to the top of the Scythian mountains, the very edge of Greek civilization. Kratos, the will of Zeus, who lives to execute his orders, is the personification of his king's unyielding power. Bia is the embodiment of violence and, as Kratos, beholden to Zeus. Kratos orders Hephaestus to bind the criminal to the face of the mountain. Prometheus has stolen fire, Hephaestus' flower, and given it to humankind. Hephaestus carries giant chains and nails. He is reluctant. Hephaestus does not want to bind Prometheus. Prometheus is his kin, Hephaestus says, and he doesn't have the courage to treat a god in such a way. However, necessity compels him to it. As he hears Kratos say, Prometheus can learn to love the tyranny of Zeus and quit his friendship with the human race. Hephaestus is compelled by the same power that holds Prometheus captive. No mortal voice or form will bring you solace, Hephaestus says to Prometheus as he chains Prometheus to the rock face. Alone, Prometheus will suffer his torment. Prometheus has granted mortals honor above their due, and he must pay the price to Zeus. With his noble visage and unyielding gaze, Prometheus stands as a beacon of defiance, his resolve unshaken despite the chains that bind him. Prometheus, chained to rock in Mount Caucasus, endures his torment stoically as he professes the eventual downfall of Zeus.
So this was the opening scene of Prometheus bound, and Prometheus, being the forcing of gods, knew what his punishment would be. And despite this, he decides to defy Zeus first, as you mentioned, making him lose face, although Zeus knew already, by tricking him with the ox bones and meat, and then by stealing the fire from the Olympus to give it again to mankind. What did Prometheus' defying actions mean for the Athenian audience that you described back then?
Well, of course, the Athenians know the end of the story. The drama, like most good dramas, starts in the middle of things, in medias res, but the Athenians know that Prometheus, in effect, wins. He's going to be released thousands of years later when Heracles, the hero, comes and shoots the eagle that's been pecking at his liver. Zeus gives in. Fire is not taken away from humans, and the Athenians can point to a number of shrines, one of which was just about a mile and a half away from where they were viewing the play, where there's an altar of Prometheus, where every year there's a torch race from the altar up to the very Acropolis, which is behind them as they're watching the show. So they know how it's going to end. Paradoxically, Prometheus knows how it's going to end. He knows that Zeus is going to give in, and he will reveal the secret to Zeus that Zeus should not produce a son or daughter who will overthrow him. And Zeus manages to find a way out of that dilemma. So you can see the kind of time disjunction. We're watching a moment in deep history, Prometheus's punishment. The second bit I would like to emphasize is the political. In the 6th century, Athens was ruled by a family of absolute rulers. We call them tyrants. They weren't necessarily bad people, but they were authoritarians. Democracy came to Athens only two generations or so before this play. And So Athenians in their own history can look back at a time when they had an absolute ruler like Zeus who was unpredictable and might have punished people. But they know how the story ends. Now they've got this wonderful radical democracy where anybody can speak up in the assembly, well, any citizen male, and you don't have to worry about a tyrant figure like Zeus. So in effect, they know that they're in a better world than this past time of Zeus punishing Prometheus.
Talking about this awareness of the concept of democracy in that sense, in a way, as a ruler, if we tend to see also this play in the eyes of Zeus, as a ruler that could not bend in, Zeus, I mean, is bound to punish Prometheus because he has gone too far. So we know he summoned him at the base of the Caucasus Mountains and ordered him to climb the precipice to punish him cruelly, and that he will be chained for eternity with no hope for escape or forgiveness, and that, as you mentioned, every day would be visited by an eagle who will pick out his liver and devour it. And every night it regrows. But nevertheless, Prometheus, as we said, accepts his punishment with dignity and conviction of his sacrifice on behalf of mankind. Could that be that the source of Prometheus' unbreakable courage came from the fact that he already knew the end?
And I think that's what makes a difference from other stories of courage. He is, after all, a divinity. He's not going to die, and he says this in the play, "You're not going to kill me." And he knows how it ends. His mother, according to Aeschylus at least, was the goddess Themis, T-H-E-M-I-S, whose name means something like the law, the way things should be. And as the son of this kind of eternal principle, he's going to last and outlast Zeus. Zeus is not going to die either, but Zeus doesn't know the future in the way that Prometheus does. I wonder whether this makes him less of a model for human beings, because we don't know the future.
Alone, Prometheus called out, "Shining bright sky, breezes swift as birds, river sources, laughing waves of the sea, all mothering earth, sun observing all, look at me. See how gods force a god to suffer."
With that wonderful introduction, which is an interpretation made by you of Prometheus' words of Aeschylus, Prometheus bound, tension rises to a crescendo as we reach the peak of this story. And Prometheus is chained to the mountain, claiming to the skies and the seas his fortune. And suddenly, from the depths of the stage, the hunting voices of a chorus formed by the daughters of Oceanus, the Titan god of the oceans and streams, rises in a sort of ethereal melody. The girls do not understand why would somebody steal the fire from the Olympus to give it to humans, and with it offend Zeus tremendously. Nevertheless, the sea nymphs see Prometheus suffering and suffer with him. The girls ask their father to appeal on Prometheus' behalf, and then there is a wonderful passage here where Oceanus and Prometheus exchange a gentleman's dialogue. Full of integrity, Oceanus is compassionate and sympathetic and of Prometheus and offers to intercede on his behalf. But Prometheus warns him against this and encourages him to leave. Oceanus ultimately leaves and agrees not to go to Zeus, but his kindness and support remains until he goes. Professor, through the whole performance, we see several passages where empathy and compassion are present. We have the nymphs, we have Oceanus, and we also have Hephaestus, who even curses his ability to forge metal and fire as he punishes Prometheus. And we also have the presence of Io, a martyr, if you will, punished by Zeus. Was Aeschylus implying that the capacity for compassion was widespread among gods and humans alike?
I think he was implying that there is, even among the gods, this capacity for empathy and compassion, which is surprising if you contrast that with other views of the gods in Greek culture. In, for example, the Iliad of Homer, the gods fight one another, and it's because they have favorites among humans, but you don't have a god who's sort of generally in favor of humans. They favor individual humans. Sometimes the human was their son or daughter. So I do think it's something new that drama captures in a way that other forms don't. You see somebody developing, interacting, gesturing, even touching another on stage. And the closeness that implies empathy is displayed before this audience of maybe 5,000, even 10,000 people.
And how should we interpret now that, I mean, we know that Prometheus knew what was coming to him, but he also knew the end of the story. How should we interpret the link between Prometheus' sacrifice and our mortality?
Well, when we mention sacrifice, we get into a deeply important cultural feature that, in effect, is always already. So the stories of Prometheus show how a particular kind of sacrifice began. The sacrifice where you put bones of the animal on the altar and the human beings eat the meat. But that's what Greeks have always already done. So the myths give you a kind of real-time developmental story of something that's already happening on the ground. In a way, it's the same paradox of Prometheus knowing what's going to happen and still doing things as he does. It's sacrifice that both characterizes the distance between mortals and gods and bridges the distance. Mortals have to eat or they die. Gods don't have to eat and they don't die. But sacrifice is a kind of contract. It says, we worship you, the gods. We acknowledge your power. You, in turn, give us the means to survive. Grain, which feeds our cattle, which we sacrifice. And Prometheus is right at the center of that exchange. It's like he is the bridge.
Excellent. He explained. Thank you. Many of the characters in Prometheus Bound feel compassion, as we mentioned, but are bound to their fear to Zeus or their servitude to him, and with the sole purpose of delivering Zeus' orders. And we talk about this already. Even Zeus is bound to his image of invulnerable power. We see that some of the characters are even inclined to, but it is only Prometheus who seems to act on his free will. And I think this is also part of this breach that you're mentioning. In the passage where Hermes arrives to get information of Zeus' fate from Prometheus, famous for his capacity of the forethought, Prometheus refuses to talk and says to him, I would not exchange my own misfortune for your slavery. I mean, how is that for a phrase? So despite his physical confinement chained to the mountain, Prometheus owns a sort of spiritual freedom. Did Greeks had already this notion of spiritual freedom, or was it more just political, like linked to a sense of justice?
I think it's very hard to separate these. And remember that the people in the theater this day, let's say it's 4:30, just for the sake of argument, which brings up the question, of course, is whether Aeschylus really composed the play or his son or somebody else. That's another debate. A mere 50 years before, the Greeks had defeated the greatest empire in the ancient world, the Persian Empire. And the Athenians, in all of their interactions with the Persians, as we read in Herodotus and other sources, constantly stressed eleutheria, freedom. So they refused to knuckle under to the empire. The Athenians themselves refused to knuckle under to be subservient to a tyrant. They want democracy. And at the same time, it's democracy that it seems to have enabled theater. That is remarkably coexistent with the development of democracy in Athens, that you have this festival downtown where you put on plays that happen to be about tyrants and democracy. So I would say, to try to put it in a briefer format, that political freedom and freedom of imagination and spiritual possibility are all one thing.
Brilliantly put. To this assessment, Professor, I would like to play a clip in which we will hear the introduction to the Manifesto of the Imagination, written by poet and President Emerita of Penn International, Jennifer Clement. You talked about the access formed by political freedom, freedom of imagination, and spiritual possibility, enabled through democracy. Clement talks about democracy too, and these kinds of freedom that enable writers and readers alike to transcend their own place in the world. Let's listen.
The opening of the Penn International Charter states that literature knows no frontiers. This speaks to both real and, no less importantly, those imagined. Penn stands against notions of national and cultural purity that seeks to stop people from listening, reading, and learning from each other. One of the most treacherous forms of censorship is self-censorship, where walls are built around the imagination and often raised from fear of attack. Penn believes the imagination allows writers and readers to transcend their own place in the world, to include the ideas of others. This place for some writers has been prison, where the imagination has meant interior freedom and often survival. The imagination is the territory of all discovery, as ideas come into being as one creates them. It is often the confluence of contradiction, found in metaphor and simile, where the most profound human experiences reside. For almost 100 years, Penn has stood for freedom of expression. Penn also stands for and believes in the freedom of the empathetic imagination, while recognizing that many have not been the ones to tell their own stories.
Consider the storm that will rise up against you. If you refuse to heed my words, a threefold tidal wave of misery, impossible to escape. For first, the Father will destroy this jagged cliff with thunder and lightning and bury you, still gripped by its embrace, inside it. Then, after an enormous span of time, you will come back again into the light, and Zeus's winged hound, a scarlet eagle, will carve your body into ragged shreds of flesh. He will return day in, day out, as an unbidden guest to feast upon your blackened liver.
This was Hermes talking to Prometheus about his punishment in Prometheus Bound. Professor, why the liver, and what is the meaning of Zeus being the eagle that devours it every day?
Yeah, I've often wondered about this. The liver is, even the ancient Greeks knew, this essential organ. What seems remarkable to me is that they seem to know that it can regenerate, as modern medicine has realized. How they knew that, I don't know. The other paradox is that even in the play, and I'm going to just quote one line, when Prometheus describes everything that he's done for humans, he says, I've given them navigation, I've given them arithmetic, I've given them divination by birds, I've told them which birds are favorable and which sinister, the habits of each species and their mutual hatreds, and the smoothness of internal organs. And now he's talking about divination by looking at the organs of animals. And I taught them what color bile should have if it is to be pleasing to the gods, i.e. when you open up the animal and you look at the internal organs and you get messages from the gods in this kind of coded system. And I told them the mottled appearance and proper shape of the liver lobe He says, La bu te poiki lein el morphion, the good shape of the liver lobe. So we have to remember that divination by looking at the liver of animals, the so-called hepatoscopy, was a major way to tell the future. So in a weird way, when Zeus's ego nibbles away at Prometheus's liver, it's like destroying the means of communicating with the gods. It's on the surface that the liver itself is a kind of communication device, because that's the way the gods give you signs of the future. So it's like Zeus trying to destroy Prometheus's trickster ability to tell the future.
Carl Jung once said, as far as we can discern, the sole purpose of human existence is to kindle a light in the darkness. In Prometheus Bound, Aeschylus underscores the infinite possibilities of human intellect and the superior power of reason over force. This impulse is the spark of potential genius, but there are also boundaries. And we were just talking about the liver and, well, another guest of this season, Thomas van Hulik, professor emeritus of surgery at the Amsterdam University Medical Center, and one of the four authors of an incredible book, beautifully illustrated, called Prometheus and the Liver Through Art and Medicine. Well, he left a question for you.
Professor Martin, Prometheus is a symbol of exploring and crossing borders. When is that hubris? When is that overconfidence that carries risk of failure and even disaster? An example is whether we as surgeons may transplant organs from animals into humans, even after genetic modification. Where are the limits?
So if I were to answer this, speaking as a modern 21st century American, I would definitely say there is the danger of hubris. And it's certainly been connected with Prometheus, as we've been reminded by last summer's movie, Oppenheimer. The movie was based on the book called The Modern Prometheus, a biography of Oppenheimer. And the message there is that Prometheus can create something that gets out of control. Of course, that's playing on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the subtitle of which was A Modern Prometheus. Dr. Frankenstein creates the monster that gets out of control. And that seems to be a kind of hubris. I don't think the ancient Greek myth of Prometheus asserts that. Because humans don't get out of control, Prometheus kindly provides them with all of the means of life, he doesn't really have hubris in the terms of the myth. If anybody, it's Zeus that has hubris. So it's a message, certainly in Greek culture generally, that things can overgrow. Hubris is even applied to plants that just get too big and have to be cut back. But I don't think we can pin it to Prometheus.
And another perfect example of this dilemma, and you were mentioning already that in the construction of the atomic bomb, and this dilemma of between human intellectual potential and progress and the risk of turning it into our own destruction, is artificial intelligence. And Prometheus transgresses essential boundaries, stealing fire. And so can artificial intelligence be seen as a threat, either as the new thief of knowledge or as a new fire, which we need to understand how to tame and put to our service. In addition to the many challenges and ethical dilemmas we will face, in your opinion, Professor, what would be the most important disruptions we could and would suffer from this fire called artificial intelligence?
Well, first of all, I do agree it's a fire that's already started. And living in California, we're constantly aware of wildfire and how once it started, it's really hard to control. Living and teaching in Silicon Valley, as I do, and commuting from San Francisco, which is the home of AI, I'm very much aware of this. And I think the first fear that people have is that somehow technology driven by AI will just take over and on its own do things like start wars or break down the infrastructure of water and electricity. I worry about that, but I worry even more as a teacher of humanities that AI will take away imagination. It will take away precisely the kind of muses, the space for transcendence that Greek theater and Greek culture cherished so much. Because once you can just say to AI, write me a novel, write me a poem, and it coughs out something that's convincing, but there's no human heart there. It's a new Pandora.
I agree with you, Professor. And I have this final question. So fire brought us not only warmth, but also the possibility of intellectual, cognitive, social, and emotional development. And the list of works, and you already mentioned some of them in art inspired by Prometheus, is infinite. Rubens and Goethe and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Lord Byron, Beethoven, Schubert, Kokoschka, Clemente Orozco, Salvatore Rosa, Kupka, and we can go on and on and on. Wherever you turn back in history, in philosophy, psychology, art, or elsewhere, you find Prometheus. Nowadays, we see products and services named after him. There's Prometheus in music, in cartoons, in musicals, and often we're presented with an image of an accessible hero, too easy version of the myth. And this happens, of course, not only with the myth of Prometheus, but in general with other myths too. The myth begins to fade away, and with it, the message it intended to deliver. And my last question is, are we killing the myth, and can myths die?
That's a very deep question, and I would like to say they don't die. I would like to say they're like Prometheus's liver. No matter how much you nibble away at it, it regenerates. I think if a culture dies, then the myths die. And the question for me would be whether, you know, we invest in certain myths that are then going to kill off a culture. And you mentioned AI, the myth of the salvation of humanity because of artificial intelligence is a really dangerous one. So let's hope that the culture doesn't die and take its myths with it. Otherwise, I'm pretty confident that myths will live.
Well, Professor, that's the hope, perhaps, that remained in the jar of Pandora.
Yes, I hope that hope is not an ill, but it's still there.
So, well, no one escapes its fates, not even Zeus, and we have sadly come to the end of our interview. Thank you, Professor Martin, for having guided us with knowledge and patience through Prometheus myth. This was a fantastic opening episode for our series, Gods. You granted us an amazing interview, sir.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk.
Thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. Please, do not forget to check this episode's description to check on Professor Richard Martin's books and articles. And if you're interested in Greek mythology, Myths of the Ancient Greeks, beautifully illustrated by Patrick Hunt and published by New American Library, is a book you ought to read. Thank you. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.